This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
When we turn our protocol on, what will happen is the device in the middle will relay the information from the two other devices on the outside.
As the UK prepares for the 2012 London Olympic Games, researchers are taking on a new kind of emergency communications channel. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, an international team of genetic researchers, including one from the Netherlands, have sequenced the DNA of that versatile vegetable, the potato.
We know the different chapters and we know on the different pages what is written, more or less. But yes, there are still, mistakes and words which we cannot really read.
Plus, new German research on how stem cells can be used in serious injury cases. But first, the World Health Organization's new guidelines as to how to stem the tide of HIV. All that and more this week on Spectrum. HIV infections among heterosexual people are falling. That's the good news. The bad news is infection rates among homosexual men and transgender people are rising. The World Health Organization warns the epidemic of HIV/AIDS will not end unless the spread of the disease among men who have sex with men and among transgender people is slowed down. With this in mind, last month, the WHO issued the first global public health guidelines aimed at reducing the spread of HIV among men who have sex with men and transgender people. The guidelines call for greater access to treatment and prevention services for HIV amongst these high-risk, vulnerable groups. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The protection of human rights is at the heart of WHO's new guidelines. It says getting rid of pervasive barriers such as stigma and criminalization will reduce HIV infections among men who have sex with men. WHO acknowledges it cannot force states to follow its recommendations, and it agrees many that are hostile to homosexuality are likely to resist them. But it contends that those that do implement its 21 recommendations will achieve positive results. The guidelines, among other things, urge policymakers to develop anti-discrimination laws, on healthcare providers to offer HIV testing, counseling, and treatment. WHO's director of HIV/AIDS department, Gottfried Hirnschall, says there's been a recent resurgence of HIV among homosexual men, particularly in industrialized countries. But data is emerging, showing new HIV epidemics also are occurring among these men in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Latin America, and Eastern Europe.
The dramatic fact is that men who have sex with men are estimated to be 20 times more likely to be HIV infected than the general populations on average. Up to 40% of men who have sex with men are estimated to be HIV positive in some countries and regions.
He adds, among transgender people, the rates are also extremely high.
Transgender people are faced with discrimination, stigma, and violence, which act as a barrier to them to accessing to HIV prevention and treatment program. Transgender community are still invisible among national and international programs.
Hua, who goes by one name, is a transgender activist from Thailand.
I grew up as a son, only son in the Chinese family. My dad, he is Chinese. And you know, Chinese families, they like to have a boy. And I am only one son in the family, so it's really difficult for him to accept at the beginning. But that is no problem right now.
Hua is 31 years old. Her looks are striking. Her long, dark hair flows down the back of a fuchsia-colored mini dress, which shows off the curves of her tall, lanky body to great advantage. Currently, she's a student in the United States and has an American boyfriend. She says Thailand is very tolerant and accepting of transgender people and homosexuals, unlike governments in the West, which need to enact laws to protect these minority groups. The reasons behind the galloping HIV rates are many. A lot of societies object to the so-called homosexual lifestyle, which they consider morally degenerate. WHO reports more than 70 countries criminalize same-sex relationships. In some, this is punishable by death. Fear of exposure, harassment, and punishment only serve to drive the problem underground and make the HIV epidemic worse. George Ayala is the executive officer of the U.S.-based Global Forum on MSM and HIV.
Most men have sex with men do not want to go for treatment for HIV because confidentiality is broken so often by doctors, nurses, and hospital staff. It's worse with sexual minorities. They will disclose openly who is men who have sex with men and who is HIV positive.
I now ask the secretary to close the voting machine, and the results of the vote is as follows.
An enthusiastic audience applauded the recent adoption by the UN Human Rights Council of an historic resolution that seeks to give gays and lesbians rights equal to those enjoyed by heterosexuals. Despite strong objections from African and Arab countries, WHO believes its passage will make it easier to persuade governments to support and disseminate its life-saving guidelines. Gottfried Hirnschall says the document contains 21 recommendations which suggest practical ways to improve access to HIV prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and care services.
Number one, there are structural recommendations, talking, for example, about changes in law and in terms of access to services, behavioral aspects, but also biomedical aspects, talking about testing, condom use, talking about access to treatment, talking about access to testing for other sexually transmitted infections, etc.
HIV experts stress no one individual intervention will work in stemming the epidemic. They say the guidelines have to be considered as a comprehensive package of services. They add the greatest impact on reducing HIV infections will be made by implementing all of the recommendations. Lisa Schlein, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Cyrus Farivar. Remember, if you can't get to a radio when Spectrum comes on in your area, don't worry, you can listen anytime at dw-world.de/spectrum via streaming audio or as a podcast. Both are really easy and completely free to access. You can also follow SciTech updates and get a preview of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_SciTech. We're at about 920 followers now, and it would be great if we could get to 1,000 by the end of August. Tell your friends, okay? Also, one more favor. If you listen to the show on podcast, please do pop over to iTunes and leave a review. That's a great way for us to expand the Spectrum community to more people online. It really helps us out. Thanks again. Now, most of us rely on mobile phones or email to maintain contact with our loved ones, and that's especially true in disaster situations. But the thing is, those networks aren't nearly as reliable as we might think that they are. People often turn to landlines when mobile networks are down, or to radio instead of internet or TV when electricity is down. And the same is true for first responders. Rescue workers have long relied on classic two-way radio to keep in touch with their dispatchers and coworkers in an emergency situation. But these communication tools may have taken a large step forward when earlier this year a pan-European project came up with a new way to use Wi-Fi in such emergency situations. The specific technology was just patented last week. From London, Robin Powell reports.
As ambulance crews and rescue teams rushed to help the victims of the London bombings in 2005, they found their work seriously hampered by communication problems. The radio system used by the emergency services wasn't compatible with the one used by staff in the underground. Neither was there any way to transmit crucial real-time data from the tunnels, like video or temperature conditions. In the wake of the attacks, the European Union set up what it's called the Peace Project. That's a redesigning of first responders' communication tools.
We had the idea to set up a wireless network on an ad hoc basis.
That's lead designer Christos Politis of Kingston University. He says that the new system takes emergency communications far beyond traditional walkie-talkies.
So essentially to allow emergency teams like police, fire brigade and so on to collaborate with each other and more importantly communicate with each other, which is not currently the case.
This ad hoc network allows users to communicate with each other using standard Wi-Fi, but doesn't necessarily connect them to the internet. It just creates a local wireless network. In a lecture hall at Kingston, Grant Miller from the research team demonstrated how the peace platform could connect three workers spread across a disaster site.
If you've got a guy in the middle, he might be able to pick up signals from both of those guys, but obviously they can't communicate to each other. So then when we turn our protocol on, what will happen is the device in the middle will relay the information from the two other devices on the outside, and they should all be able to communicate to each other.
Okay, and what kind of information can you pass between each?
It's what we call an IP network. So it could be video, it could be voice, it could be photos. Okay, so I'm going to talk into this device now and hopefully it will come out of the other two devices. Hello, Arvind. Can you hear me? Hello, I'm broadcasting now. Can you hear me? So you heard that came out of the two devices as planned.
The Peace Platform maintains the flow of communication by ensuring that if one device drops out of the network, perhaps a rescue worker moves out of Wi-Fi range, the protocol finds the next best route for the information via other devices. On the other hand, if that rescue worker moves out of the range of all the other devices, he will lose touch with his colleagues. It was developed in collaboration with other European researchers, including members from Greece, Germany, France, Portugal, Spain and Sweden. Nevertheless, Politis believes that the system is robust enough to challenge Europe's current emergency radio standard, known as TETRA.
Probably our solution will be an extension or a parallel system working together with these TETRA systems, or possibly even in the future replacing the TETRA systems.
All the British emergency services, as well as the London Underground, currently use a TETRA provider, a German company called Airwave. One of the company's directors, John Lewis, says that even though TETRA can't send data as fast as Wi-Fi, it's much more robust.
The TETRA technology delivers what is today the most important capability for our users, which is mission-critical voice functionality. That's the application that our users today use more than anything else.
And he's not the only one raising questions about this new peace project. Jennifer Cole of the think tank, the Royal United Services Institute for Defence and Security Studies, says that Wi-Fi just isn't nearly as reliable.
The idea that a firefighter going into a burning building with hazardous materials at high temperatures could get out a small iPad, which is, you know, relatively easily damaged, it's not going to work in that kind of heat, is really missing the point of the situations that they need to be used in.
The Peace Project is already moving far beyond iPads and smartphones, however. In the pipeline is a data recorder that can transmit real-time information, such as location, temperature, video, and even vital signs, via the Peace Platform. Airwave's John Lewis admits that such broadband technologies are revolutionising his business.
So I think eventually, certainly in the longer term, that technology will likely replace TETRA, albeit it may be an evolution of TETRA rather than a complete replacement.
Whatever kind of emergency communication system prevails, it's clear that 6 years on, one of the key lessons from the London bombings is still being taken very seriously. And as London prepares for the 2012 Olympic Games next summer, it's taking just about every possible precaution. Robin Powell for Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Coming up, a conversation with a Dutch scientist about sequencing the almighty potato. But first, here's Kate Laycock with the news.
A group of unknown hackers have penetrated the website of German supermarket giant Rewe. Earlier this week, the company admitted that tens of thousands of its customer email addresses were taken in a breach on a company social networking site. Rewe had created the site as a way for people to exchange trading cards and stickers that the company was giving out as part of a summer promotion. However, a company spokesperson told the Süddeutsche Zeitung newspaper that no significant data, like credit card information, was lost. In other digital security news, the EU's Commissioner for the Digital Agenda, Nelly Kroes, said last week that she was opening a new public consultation to see if Europe needs stronger data breach notification and regulation. But we need consistency across the EU so businesses don't have to deal with a complicated range of different national schemes, she said in Brussels last week. The new plan echoes a similar proposal by Kroes's colleague Vivian Redding, the EU's Justice Commissioner. She said in May that companies need to notify their customers much more quickly after a breach does occur. The current consultation is open until early September. Last Friday, a group of Belgium newspapers said that Google had blocked them from search results in what they are calling a retaliation over a copyright lawsuit. Google, meanwhile, says that a court order requires them to do so. The papers won a legal case against Google, saying that the company had no right to link to their articles on Google News without payment or permission. However, the organisation, called Copy Press, said that now the papers have been removed from Google's search results as well as Google News. A Google spokesperson said that the company would be happy to restore the papers if they would dismiss Google's previous penalties. Just in time for the summer vacation, Google has announced that it has added a live traffic layer to Google Maps for 13 different European countries, ranging from Germany and Spain to Luxembourg and Denmark. In a blog post last week, the company said this would include all freeways and highways, as well as large roads in major cities. The feature shows in real time how traffic is flowing, marking green as light traffic and red as heavy. The feature has already been used in the United States for 3 years.
Kate Laycock with the news there. Stem cell research is one of the hottest subjects in biology and medicine today. That's the study of cells that we all have that can be molded or directed into becoming cells in a specialized tissue, like bone or hair follicles. There's currently lots of research of stem cell treatments that might take the body's own stem cells and use them to treat all kinds of things, from baldness to infertility. But here in Germany, a group of scientists have begun a new study to heal wounds, particularly serious ones where the limb or part of the body might otherwise be amputated. Sarah Steffen presents this report.
Although it's often derided, fat tissue is far from just being useless. It contains approximately 500 times more stem cells than bone marrow. And these so-called mesenchymal stem cells are very active. Scientists can divide them and make other cell types arise, such as vascular cells or skin cells, which are very important for the healing process. For the past 3 months, German scientists have been working on a new technique to take a person's own stem cells from fat tissue and use them to treat serious injuries, which might otherwise result in amputation. Dr. Lukas Prantl is one of the project's researchers at the University Hospital Regensburg in southern Germany.
These cells are still not fully mature, and they have the potential to develop from an immature state to a mature state. They develop vessels and certain structures. This also applies to the surface layer of the wound, the epidermis. These cells bring about a reduction of the wound and faster healing.
Brantel, who is also the director of the Center for Plastic Surgery at the hospital, says he removes approximately 50 milliliters of fat with a suction cannula. From this, he can harvest about 2 million stem cells and, on the same day, drizzle them with a solution into the open wound of the same patient.
We have already treated patients in the attempt to heal them. These are patients who have exhausted all other treatment options. And especially with patients like that, we've seen that we could close wounds within 3 months. We're confident that we can keep successfully moving forward.
Similar experiments with stem cells for healing have also run at the St. Francis Hospital in Berlin. Dr. Berthold Amann from the Vascular Center specializes in patients with vascular occlusions in the leg that have led to significant circulatory problems.
If no more blood can get through, then no oxygen can either. And that leads to a situation where the nerve endings are in desperate need of oxygen. The patient perceives this as pain. We've seen quite often where the toes already are turning black in places, mummification, necrosis. If this expands to the foot or the lower leg, then we see large, sometimes palm-sized open wounds that show no tendency toward healing.
In Germany alone, as many as 30,000 amputations are performed per year due to constricted arteries preventing the flow of blood to the legs. Dr. Amann's technique with stem cells forms new blood vessels in the leg, and thus gets the circulation going again. First, Dr. Amann takes about 250 milliliters of bone marrow blood from the pelvis of those affected, runs it through a centrifuge to separate the stem cells it contains, and injects them into the leg along the muscle. This usually requires about 40 to 60 injections.
Wir können sagen, dass sich in der Tat.
As a matter of fact, in patients that we gave bone marrow stem cells, the wound healed significantly better. We also measured better blood circulation. The oxygen level in the patient's foot that was treated with the stem cells is significantly higher than the patients that were given placebo injections.
Also Placebo-Injektionen erhielten.
This new stem cell study began with 94 patients at the St. Francis Hospital in Berlin. Whether the treatment will mean fewer leg amputations, researchers should be able to reach a conclusion in about 6 months. Sarah Steffen, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And finally today, let's move to one more frontier of science, genetic engineering and genetic sequencing. It seems like all the time scientists are laying out the blueprint of more and more plants and animals. In fact, just earlier this month, a British team said it had sequenced the genome of the naked mole rat. And on the food side, recently Canadian scientists have announced that they're working on sequencing the DNA of the wheat genome. But just last week, the 14-nation Potato Genome Sequencing Consortium has revealed the first genetic sequence of the potato in the journal Nature. They say that this may have profound effects on this common foodstuff. To learn more, I spoke with Richard Visser, a plant biologist at Wageningen University and Research Center in the Netherlands.
I have here in front of me you and your colleagues' paper that was published very recently in Nature. And the title of the article is Genome Sequence and Analysis of the Tuber Crop Potato. Can you tell me what that means exactly?
Okay, that's a good question, and I try to answer it as best as I can. So what we try to do is to elucidate the sequence, so the DNA sequence order of the potato. In let's say modern genetics and modern breeding, we now are in a phase where if we have sequence information, and sequence information is the DNA composition, then we can much easier devise markers and identify the genes which are important for certain traits. So it means that we, of every chromosome in the potato, so potato has, at least the potato we grow in our fields, has 12 chromosomes. It's a tetraploid, meaning that there are four pairs of chromosomes. And from every chromosome, we tried to elucidate the order of the base pairs which are present in the DNA, so the A, C, T, and G.
Right. Is there one basic type of potato? I guess I would have assumed that there would be many, many different types.
Yeah, that's correct. So what we in fact also did, although it says the potato, you're correct in stating that there are many types. So what we actually did was we sequenced a potato. And in this case, we sequenced a particular type of potato because of what I already earlier said. The potato has these four different genomes, in fact, in one plant, and that makes it very difficult to sequence. So we went down to a somewhat, let's say, simpler version of the potato in a diploid form, so only two genomes. But we have sequenced this potato genome, and it means that you can compare it, for instance, with we have now a book. And of this book, we know the different chapters, and we know on the different pages what is written, more or less. But yes, there are still, let's say, mistakes and words which we cannot really read. And that means that if you have a different type of potato, it might be that there the words can be somewhat different. So not having a complete different meaning, but maybe a synonymous meaning.
I noticed here on the paper that you have a number of colleagues in many countries around the world, including in China and many other places. I'm wondering, was this designed to be an international collaborative scientific effort from the beginning, or were a lot of you working on it simultaneously and then got together?
No, it was intended to be an international effort already right from the beginning. Because when we started about 5-6 years ago, at that time the sequencing costs were still very high. There was at that time also really only one method of sequencing, and that was very expensive. So my idea was at that time that if we can collaborate trying to sequence the potato genome, then it might be possible to achieve that. So that's why I tried to get all the, let's say, major potato growing countries or culturally important countries for potato involved. So each had also to organize their own money At that time, the idea was that every country or every group of countries or institutes would sequence one of the 12 chromosomes. And then if we would have 12 partners, yeah, then we would, in principle, have sufficient partners to have the sequence of the potato ready in a couple of years. Well, about halfway or maybe 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the technologies for sequencing changed dramatically. It became much cheaper. And, of course, that led to all kind of different changes. And that is why we now have been able to finish the sequence relatively faster than we thought when we were busy sequencing in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. What do you expect potato growers to be able to do now that you, or potato breeders, I guess, to be able to do now that you have sequenced this?
Well, of course, it takes some time before new scientific findings are, let's say, drizzling through to the practical breeders. But in principle, the idea, and that is being done already by Dutch breeders, as far as I know, I have no idea about breeders in other countries, is that they indeed use the sequence information to design markers for specific traits, which they then can follow. Potato is a very interesting crop, but the breeding is quite difficult. And it means that for many traits, you have to wait 4 or 5 years. So after you have made a cross between two plants, you get seeds, also in potato. And in many cases, the breeders, they select every year the best plants from those, let's say, 100,000 with which they start. And in a certain time, let's say in year 4 or 5 of this process, they have about 200 seeds left. And then they can make of every plant sufficient tubers for all kinds of tests. Well, they have to wait 4 or 5 years and every time select plants which they afterwards throw away. If you have markers, then you can already in the first year, your 100,000 plants select for a particular trait in which you're interested. So all the ones which do not have that trait, you can throw away.
So in other words, you can speed up that breeding process.
Yes. Yeah. So mm-hmm. You can only work, let's say, with the plants of which you know that they contain at least some of the traits which are really important.
So because you do work in potatoes, are you an expert at cooking potatoes too?
No, not so much. I can cook potatoes, but I follow the leads on the plastic bags. If it says hard boiling or soft boiling or cooking, that's about it. I'm not a master chef.
All right, very good. Well, Dr. Fassier, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Man, I'm hungry for some Belgian fries right about now. That just about wraps it up this week on Spectrum. Remember, you can always find us between shows at dw-world.de/science and on Twitter at dw_SciTech. And of course, you can always send me story tips, questions, comments, praise, or dissent via good old-fashioned email to feedback.english@dw-world.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. If you like, you can send me a postcard or letter, the really old-fashioned way, to Deutsche Welle, Spectrum, English Service, 53110, Bonn, Germany. And of course, the Spectrum blog is always available at blogs.dw-world.de/spectrum. No matter how you contact us, don't forget to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.